Hi, everyone.
Hi, guys, gals, pals, and ghouls.
Welcome to Wicked, Weird, and Grim, your number one podcast for a trip through the history of the odd, haunting, and mystifying. I'm Ara.
And I'm Caroline. Together, we are the Grimm Sisters.
Today, we have our official Christmas episode coming to you guys. And of course, because we know you guys love true crime so much, we decided to give you a Christmas gift. And we're doing a Christmas-related true crime story. So this case is pretty well known in the true crime community. It's not well known to me, but I'm not versed in this area of expertise like Caroline is. But we hope that you'll stick around as we have some undisclosed details and some updates that aren't always included in other podcasts and other sources.
So our story, of course, starts on Christmas Eve in 1945. When 11 of the 12 members of an Italian-American immigrant family went to bed in their home in Fayetteville, West Virginia. So we're back in West Virginia. The last of the 10 children, their second oldest son, Joe, was away serving in the Army in World War II at the time.
This was none other than the Sauter family, and this is the tragic, infamous tale of the mysterious disappearance and or possible death of five of their 10 children on that fated night.
Born Giorgio Sadu in Sardinia, Italy in 1895, Giorgio adopted the name George upon immigrating to the United States at just 13 years old.
And George first found work on Pennsylvania railroads supplying water and similar supplies to the workers before becoming a driver in Smithers, West Virginia. George then finally started his own company, Sauter's Trucking, which is still business today. And he started this initially to haul what's called fill dirt to construction sites and later to haul coal that was mined in the region.
George met his wife, Jenny Cipriani, in Smithers as she was the local storekeeper's daughter. And the Sauters settled in a two-story timber frame house right outside of Fayetteville, which was a nearby town with a large population of Italian immigrants. By 1923, they had their first child together, John.
And soon their family grew. John was followed by their second oldest son, Joe, in 1924, their eldest daughter, Marion, in 1926, George Jr. in 1929, Maurice in 1931, Martha Lee in 1933, Louis in 1935, Jenny Irene in 1937, Betty Dolly in 1939, and their final and youngest child, Sylvia, in 1942. It's a lot of kids.
Yeah, they had so many kids. My grandfather on my dad's side was one of 10 children. So his family was like this too, which is wild. Like, I can't even imagine.
Like, that poor woman. God bless her.
For real. So during this time, George's business was thankfully thriving. And it kind of honestly had to be with the amount of kids they had. Like, they would have been in big trouble if they weren't making money. But yeah, thankfully, they kind of, you know, got through the Great Depression, you know, with their business still doing well. And the Sauters were even said to be, quote unquote, one of the most respected middle class families around.
But George had strong opinions and was definitely not shy about expressing them, which sometimes alienated community members and elicited aggression towards him and the family. In particular, his fierce opposition to the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini resulted in strong arguments with and even threats by other members of the Italian immigrant community.
I always think it's really cool that he was such an outspoken anti-fascist. Like, go George, you rock.
I agree. I really respect that.
For example, in October 1945, George rebuffed a traveling life insurance salesman. The salesman then threatened George, saying, quote, "Your goddamn house is going up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed. You are going to be paid for the dirty remarks you have been making about Mussolini," end quote.
That's so intense.
Yeah. Like, that's imagine the that ultimate you just threat. Enter the door and you're like, nah, dude, we don't want any, like, sorry, like, we're not interested in insurance right now. And the guy just starts screaming at you about Mussolini. Like, what? Another visitor to the house, ostensibly seeking work, took the occasion to go around to the back and warn George that a pair of fuse boxes would, quote, cause a fire someday, end quote.
So in the weeks before Christmas that year, kind of related to these threats and these kind of weird situations, George's older sons had also noticed a strange car parked along the main highway through Fayetteville, U.S. Highway 21. And there was a man sitting inside that was intensely watching the younger Sauter children as they returned home from school. Really creepy behavior.
Yeah. Fast forward to Christmas Eve of that same year, so 1945, with the Sauter family celebrating that night, just like always. The oldest daughter, Marion, who was 19, surprised her three younger sisters, Martha, who was 12, Jenny, who was 8, and Betty, who was 5, with new toys. And the younger children were so excited that they asked their mother, Jenny Sr., if they could stay up past their normal bedtime so they could, you know, play with their toys.
And the mother, Jenny, told the children that they could stay up later than 10 p.m., which was their normal bedtime, so long as the two oldest boys who were still awake, 14-year-old Maurice and 9-year-old Louis, turned in the cows and fed the chickens before bed. So the oldest boys, John, who was 22, and George Jr., who was 16, who normally would have done these tasks before bed, they had already gone to bed with their father because they'd all been working all day. They were tired. And then Jenny, the mother, went upstairs to bed with Sylvia, the 2-year-old.
Oddly, the telephone rang at 12:30 a.m., rousing Jenny from sleep and, you know, forcing her downstairs to answer it. The caller was apparently a woman whose voice Jenny didn't recognize, and she was kind of asking Jenny for a name that she also wasn't familiar with. The sound of laughter and the clinking of glasses echoed in the background, so suggesting that there was a party going on.
And Jenny told the caller that she had reached the wrong number, later recalling that the woman let out, quote, a weird laugh at that. Jenny then hung up and returned to bed. As she did, she noticed that, weirdly, the lights were still on and the curtains weren't drawn, two things that the children normally did when they stayed up later than their parents. And also the front door was unlocked.
That's concerning. But also I feel like people in this time period didn't lock their doors, but like, I feel like there's a lot of crimes that happened in ye olden days that could have been prevented by locking doors. Back to the point here, which is that Jenny woke up in the middle of the night to this phone call and she noticed the lights were on and the front door was unlocked, which was unusual. So the oldest daughter, Marion, had fallen asleep on the living room couch. So Jeannie just, you know, assumed that the other kids had gone back up to the attic where they slept. She closed the curtains, turned out the lights, locked the door, and returned to bed.
Unfortunately, Jenny would just not get a good night's sleep that night. So at 1 a.m., she was again awakened by a really loud bang coming from an object hitting the roof of the house, apparently, before the noise kind of shifted into sounding like the object was like rolling around or rolling off of the roof, something like that. And she listened for a little while longer, but she didn't hear anything else, so she just went back to sleep.
It's like the beginning of the Santa Claus, and except very different. Very different story.
I feel like personally I would never go back to sleep after that. But then I think it's so easy for us to sit here and be like, oh, well, I wouldn't do X when we're listening to a true crime story or something like that. But in the actual moment, oh, it's a pigeon. And then just like go back to sleep or something.
Yeah. Well, like, the other day I was reading like just a Wikipedia page about a crime that happened. And I was just sitting there thinking like, how freaky is that, that this happened to somebody and that it could happen to anybody, you know? But I would never in years be like, oh, it's going to happen to me. Like, I would just never think that. Even though I consciously know that it could, you know?
And even though we lock our doors.
Yeah. I feel like you just can't fathom that anything that crazy is going to happen to you, especially like on Christmas Eve. Like, it's just kind of it's unfathomable.
Oh, definitely not. Yeah.
Also, too, it's a lot easier for our generation to like wake up in the night and then not go back to sleep because we have phones to occupy us and stuff like that. Whereas like back then, what were
that's
you going
to
do in
the
middle
true.
Of the night?
I guess I just have to go back to sleep. It's ye olden days.
Nothing today. There's nothing to do. It's 1945. It is, like we said, it's so much different when you're not in the know about what's going to happen next. And so Jenny went back to sleep, but then she woke up again around 2 a.m. smelling smoke. So this poor woman now has been awakened 3 times in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve. And this time it's smoke. So, of course, when she smells smoke, she jumps up. She finds George's office on fire. And it's really important to note that the room was really close to the telephone line and the fuse box, which kind of harks back to the ominous warning from that stranger that had said the fuse boxes would, quote, cause a fire someday. It's really scary.
And Jenny woke George immediately, of course. And George woke his oldest sons, John and George Jr., and they all immediately fled the house. Marion joined them on the bottom, I'm guessing the bottom floor, because she was sleeping on the couch downstairs, if you guys remember. And then Sylvia, the baby of the family, the two-year-old, she slept in a crib in George and Jenny's room. So she was already with them as well. Mm-hmm. But they still had five children missing. So all the five children who normally slept upstairs, which was 14-year-old Maurice, 12-year-old Martha, 9-year-old Louis, 8-year-old Jenny, and 5-year-old Betty, they were all still missing.
Jenny, George, John, and Marion had been frantically yelling to the remaining children upstairs in the attic as they could not go up because the staircase was already on fire, but they heard no response. The eldest child, John, said in his initial police interview that he had actually gone up to the attic to alert his siblings that were sleeping there, but he later changed his story, saying that he had only called up there and didn't actually see them.
And George frantically tried to save the children, breaking a window to try to re-enter the house in a different way, which actually resulted in him slicing his arm on the broken glass, and it left a huge bloody slash on his arm. But the fire had consumed too much at that point, and he wasn't able to enter on the ground floor.
So George instead decided to climb directly into the upstairs window using a ladder that he always kept propped up against the house. However, the ladder was missing, and you know, of course, he was just kind of like, okay, the ladder's missing. What am I going to do? So he wasn't deterred by this, and he decided to go back back one of his two giant coal trucks up to the house and climb on top of it to reach the upstairs window. But mysteriously, neither of these trucks would start. He had two of them. Neither of them would start. He was so desperate as to try to scoop water to put the fire out from rain barrels, but the rain barrels had frozen.
And even more horrendous, their phone wasn't working. So Marion, the oldest daughter, she sprinted to the nearby neighbor's house in order to call the Fayetteville Fire Department, but there was no operator response. And the six daughters, because of this, were forced to watch their family home burn and collapse over the next 45 minutes, able to do nothing but think of the five lives inside being lost.
The blaze was so huge that even a neighbor who saw the fire called from a nearby tavern. But again, there was no operator that responded. The neighbor, in response, drove to town to locate Fire Chief F.J. Morris. Upon locating him, the chief sounded the Fayetteville fire alarm, calling a firefighter who called another firefighter who called another firefighter, and so on. It was like a phone tree. Despite the fire department being only 2.5 miles from the Sauter family house, the fire crew, which was lacking manpower due to the war, didn't arrive until 8 a.m., so the house burned for like hours and hours before the fire department got there. Further, the chief couldn't drive the fire truck, which makes no sense. So they had to wait for someone to drive who was available. The Sauter's home at that point was just like a pile of ash. I mean, the fire was basically out by the time the fire department got there.
Honestly, this part of the story like made me so upset that they basically waited like over five or six hours for the fire department to come and answer this call. And I can't imagine like feeling so helpless and having to like literally watch as your home collapses with your children inside of it.
Yeah.
It's just so sad. So when the firefighters arrived at 8 a.m., one of whom was actually Jenny's brother, they could do nothing more than sift through the ashes of what was left of the house. After searching for over 2 hours, Chief Morris informed the Sauters that they had not found any bones, as they should have found the children's bones because they were in the burning house. However, this is disputed, as another account attests that the fire crew did in fact find bone fragments and internal organ tissue, but they chose not to tell the family. So, regardless, modern-day fire professionals have labeled the search administered by the fire crew as severely lacking and, quote, cursory at best. Despite all of this, Fire Chief Morris believed the five children had actually died in the fire and their bodies had simply been burned up completely.
The fire chief told George to not disturb the site of the fire for any reason in order for the state fire marshal's office to come in and conduct a more thorough investigation. But after only 4 days, George and Jeannie just couldn't stand the sight of the wreckage any longer. So George bulldozed 5 feet of dirt over the site of the fire, and this was done with the intention of converting the site into a memorial garden for their five children.
This is super suspicious to me. Wouldn't you want the case solved, and thus you wouldn't have bulldozed over this site and possibly contaminated evidence? And I don't know, this just makes zero sense to me. I am trying to like understand it from the perspective of wanting your children to be at rest, but I guess it's all different for everyone. This type of action seems like guiltiness to me.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, when we say guilt, that doesn't necessarily mean that like the Sauter family actually had anything to do with the fire. To me, it could easily just mean they feel guilty for not recognizing the signs that something bad was going to happen, or for not doing more to get their children out, even though they did everything they could. I think in a situation like this, the family is going to feel guilty no matter what. There's just nothing can ever be done to make that different. And so I wondered on some level if part of the reason the family was so willing to just sort of memorialize the site like that was because they knew that if the children were in the house, they were going to find the body when the state fire marshal got there. And the idea of like finding the bodies, having to see the bodies, all of that was just really traumatic. And they thought, well, maybe if we bulldoze it and we cover it up, they'll never find the bodies and we'll never have to look at them. But I mean, that's just my thinking. I don't know. Anyways, the local area coroner convened an inquest the very next day, which was essentially a trial to determine the cause of the fire. The inquest ruled that the fire was accidental and caused by, quote, faulty wiring, which is very suspicious because, you know, they had just had the house rewired and it was supposedly really good, but who knows. Very suspiciously, among the jurors in the inquest was the man who had threatened George that his house would be burned down and his children, quote, destroyed in retribution for his anti-Mussolini remarks. At the inquest's conclusion, 5 death certificates for the children were issued December 30th, attributing their cause of death as, quote, fire or suffocation.
All this just seems like it happened so fast to me. I don't know if it's just because the bureaucracy of things to me, like, always seems to take a while, but I don't know if it was because it was a small town and they were rocked by this major event, but I don't know. The bureaucracy is working really well here, and that's suspicious to me. You know, death certificates issued, case declared faulty wiring. Just feels weird to me. It feels like a cover up.
It's also really strange since this all happened at Christmas and New Year's. So, you know, you'd think that they would all, you know, be really short staffed, you know, it'd be hard to find jurors, things like that, right? Because nobody's going to want to do that stuff between, you know, December 24th and New Year's. Like, that's just not how it works, I guess, you know? I feel like that's the time of year when everything's going to start moving really, really slowly. But I don't know. That's weird. Despite the, you know, efficiency in bureaucracy here, the story continued to be muddled and warped. The local newspaper went back and forth on its story, stating in contradictory reports that the bodies had all been found, or that part of one body was found, or that none of the bodies were found.
And the funeral for the 5 children was conducted 3 days after the issued death certificates on January 2nd of 1946. Unfortunately, Jenny and George could not attend because they were too grief-stricken to do so, but the remaining 4 children, I think, of the Sauter family did attend.
After this quick investigation, inquest, and funerary service, the Sauter family tried to begin the process of rebuilding their lives. They planted flowers in the soil bulldozed over the house, which Jenny actually tended very carefully too for the rest of her life. However, as the shock and grief wore off, the official findings of the fire started to weigh on them. For example, they wondered why, if the fire had been caused by, quote, faulty wiring, that the family's Christmas lights had remained on throughout the fire's early stages when the power should have gone out. George thought back to that one time that a stranger had warned that the fuse box would cause a fire. At the time, George had been puzzled since he had just had the house rewired when an electric stove was installed. And the electric company had said afterwards that it was all safe. And this made the Sauters begin to think that perhaps the stranger actually had something to do with the fire.
And Jenny was further confused by how 5 of her children who perished in the fire did not leave any traces. There was not a bone in sight. So she cross-checked with the printed results of another fire in the local newspaper that had killed a family of 7, and the skeletal remains of all 7 victims were reportedly found. So she was driven to conduct her own kind of experiment here, kind of burning various animal bones like chickens, cow, pig, to see if the fire consumed the bones. But each time she did so, she was left with a heap of bones, just slightly charred. And to her, if the household appliances and the tin roof pieces had only been slightly disfigured in the fire, how could her children's bones not have remained? Further, a local crematorium employee informed Jenny that bones still remain even in their crematoriums, which, you know, the bodies are burned for about 2 hours at around 2000 Fahrenheit or around 1100 Celsius. So definitely the house probably wouldn't have reached this temperature, but even more so, their house was destroyed in 45 minutes. So there's just a lot of things that don't make sense around the bones not being there.
Yeah, the crematorium thing, I mean, that would really concern me, because an interesting thing about cremains is that it's not just ashes, right? Like, it's literally pulverized bones. Like, that's literally part of that substance. And it's because bones do, you know, survive. Weird things continued to ensue regarding the fire. A telephone repairman who consulted for the Sodders elicited that the phone line had not been burned through in the fire as the Sodders had initially thought, but rather cut. To do so, the individual had to have been both willing and able to climb the 14 feet, which is 4.3 meters, up the telephone pole and then reach 2 feet or 61 centimeters away from it to do so. So somebody was very dedicated in cutting this phone line.
And neighbors had also recently reported a man stealing what's called a block and tackle around the time of the fire, which was rigging for lifting heavy loads, but specifically this one was for removing car engines. So this man was apprehended and arrested, and he actually admitted to the theft. And he had also claimed that he had been the one to cut the phone line, thinking it was a power line, but he denied having anything to do with the fire.
Suspiciously, no record identifying the subject exists. Further, why he would have wanted to cut any utility lines to the Sodder house while simply stealing block and tackle has never been explained. So, pretty weird.
And then, in another turn of events, they found this missing ladder from the side of the house that was always there. And they found it at the bottom of an embankment, 75 feet or 23 meters away. So that was very clearly purposeful. Like, that was not accidental. You don't just accidentally lose your ladder 75 feet away down an embankment. Like, what?
Yeah. Well, and like, George always kept the ladder propped up against the house. Like, that's just where he kept it. So, I mean, I don't think he would have just misplaced it, you know? That's not how that works.
Yeah.
The Sodders' trucks being unable to start on the night of the fire were of pretty big interest. George believed they could have been tampered with, perhaps by the thief who cut the phone line and stole their block and tackle. But one of George's son-in-laws later told a newspaper that Sodder and his sons may have very well simply flooded the engines in their haste to start the trucks. But I don't know.
I have no idea about how vehicles work, so I can't confirm.
I feel like every paragraph, I read, I'm just like, but I don't know.
But we actually don't have expertise on this, so we're just going to be very critical of this, and then in actuality have no idea. That's a true crime life, becoming small experts. Others suspected that the wrong number call to the Sodder house that happened that night with the woman and the weird laugh and everything, that could have been connected to the fire. But investigators apparently later located this woman who had made the call, and she just stated it had been a wrong number. So who knows?
It very well could have been. I mean, it does seem like they were at a party, so I don't know, but who knows?
Yeah. Kept imagining they're at this like mass party and everyone, for some reason, hated George Sodder, and like they were just waiting to
party.
Like go and set his house on fire.
Yeah.
Literally, I don't know, like a pro Mussolini party.
Then evidence emerged indicating that the fire had actually been set deliberately. A bus driver passing through Fayetteville late Christmas Eve said that he'd actually seen people throwing, quote, balls of fire at the house. A few months later, after the winter snow had melted, Sylvia found a small, hard, dark green rubber ball-like object at the site. George recalled his wife's account that she had heard a loud bang on the roof and a rolling sound before the fire, and concluded that the ball looked like a napalm, quote, pineapple bomb, or hand grenade, or, you know, some other incendiary device. Thus, the family determined that the fire had actually started on the roof and not due to, quote, faulty wiring, like the fire marshal had said.
Even more compelling, these witnesses came forward, or new witnesses came forward, claiming to have seen the missing Sodder children themselves. So, a woman who watched the fire from the road reported that she had seen some of the children peering out of a passing car while the house was burning. Another woman at a rest stop between Fayetteville and Charleston said that she'd actually served them breakfast the next morning. She noted there was a car with Florida license plates in the rest stop's parking lot, and this is seen to have been like an illusion that a Florida car was the one who picked up the Sodder children and took them, I guess, towards Charleston.
The Sodders, of course, wanting to look into these claims further, ended up hiring a private investigator named C.C. Tinsley from nearby Gauley Bridge, West Virginia. Tinsley was the one who informed the Sodders that the insurance salesman who had threatened George over his anti-Mussolini statements had actually been on the coroner's jury that ruled the fire an accident. Tinsley also was the one who learned of the rumors around Fayetteville that despite his report to the Sodders that no remains had been found in the ashes, Fire Chief Morris had actually found a heart at the scene, which he later packed into a metal dynamite box and secretly buried at the scene, which is so weird.
I know. This is like the weirdest set of events relating to this thing. That's why it's so confusing and so unsolved, I think. Morris had apparently confessed that he had buried this heart to the local minister, who in turn confirmed it to George. So much for anonymous confession. Which, by the way, CC Tinsley is such an awesome name and the perfect name for a private investigator.
It sounds like a private investigator. Like, if I heard that name and knew no context, I would be like, he's a PI.
CC Tinsley at the service. So George and Tinsley actually went to confront Morris, of course, and Morris agreed to show them where he'd buried the box. Upon digging it up, they took the contents to a local funeral director who, after examining it, told them it was, in reality, fresh beef liver that had never been exposed to fire. More rumors circulated around Fayetteville. Rumors that Morris had admitted the box with the liver had indeed not come from the fire originally and had supposedly placed it there in hope that the Saunders would find it and be satisfied that the missing children had indeed died in the fire. This is so sketchy because, first of all, why would they think that finding this metal box on the property with their supposed child's heart in it, that makes no sense at all that they would have died in the fire? How would their one of their hearts have gotten in a metal box on the scene? Like, what is happening here?
If he wanted to comfort them somehow and be like, well, here's remains, why wouldn't he have just said, well, we found remains, but all it was this heart or liver?
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
Why wouldn't he say?
And also, why not use an actual anatomical heart? Why are we using beef liver? What is happening here?
Anyway, with all of these weird events, George tried to involve the FBI into investigating what he labeled as a kidnapping. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover personally responded to his letter that the matter was a local problem and was not in their jurisdiction. However, he added that if the local authorities requested the Bureau's assistance, he would, of course, direct agents to assist. But the Fayetteville police and fire departments declined to do so. And that is true. I will say that the FBI usually does have to be invited by the police. I think there are times when they get involved, like there are certain types of crimes that the FBI just automatically, I think, has in their jurisdiction. But if it's something like this, where it's a little bit murky or, you know, whatever, I think the local people have to say, hey, we need your help for the FBI to come in. I think that's what I learned. Thing is, like,
thanks, Criminal Minds. The thing to me that's so weird is that the Fayetteville police and fire departments declined.
To be fair, like, I think sometimes it's really common for police to get like tunnel vision about certain crimes where they are just convinced that the first answer they came up with has to be the answer, you know, and you see this a lot where police will like harass a suspect for years and years, like decades sometimes. And the suspect had absolutely nothing to do with the crime and was completely innocent and was like grieving the person who got murdered or whatever. Like they were not a perpetrator in any way, but the police were just so convinced that they had to do something about it. And then years and years later, they go back, they test the DNA. And sure enough, it was some random stranger they'd never heard of. And you know, you see cases like that all the time. And so, I mean, it's very possible that in a situation like this, the local police, who definitely seem fairly incompetent over their heads in a potential crime like this, it's very possible that they were kind of like, nothing like that would ever happen here. It was just a fire and it was just a tragedy, you know? So it's very possible that being against that, they still were just like, well, there's just no way. Even if the evidence doesn't match up to what we're saying, it has to still be true, which is really human, but also really bad. So I don't know.
It's just like the fear of their own ineptitude is preventing these people from knowing. Yeah, it just bothers me.
So in August 1949, so a few years after the fire, George managed to persuade Oscar Hunter, a pathologist from Washington, D.C., to oversee a fresh excavation of the house site. After an exhaustive search, various artifacts, including a dictionary owned by the children and some coins, were discovered. Among the findings were several small bone fragments identified as human lumbar vertebrae.
These bone fragments were forwarded to Marshall T. Newman, who was an expert at the Smithsonian, for examination. Newman's analysis confirmed that these were lumbar vertebrae, all originating from the same person. The report from the Smithsonian said, quote, "The human bones consist of four lumbar vertebrae belonging to one individual. Since the transverse recesses are fused, the age of this individual at death should have been 16 or 17 years. The top limit of age should have been around 22, since the centra, which normally fuse at 23, are still unfused. On this basis, the bones show greater skeletal maturation than one would expect for a 14-year-old boy, the oldest missing solder child. It is, however, possible, although not probable, for a boy of 14 and a half years old to show 16 to 17 maturation, end quote. So therefore, all of this summarizes that based on the age, it was improbable these bones belonged to any of the five missing solder children, given that the oldest, Maurice, was only 14 at the time. But the report acknowledges that, you know, in some rare cases, this has happened, that the bones have been belonging to a younger child who just matured earlier, but it wasn't at all common.
Newman noted that the bone exhibited no signs of exposure to fire. What? Moreover, he expressed bewilderment, deeming it highly unusual and, quote, very strange that only these bones were unearthed, given that a brief wood fire should have left complete skeletons of all the children. The report concluded that these vertebrae most probably originated from the soil George had used to level the site with a bulldozer. Later on, Tinsley allegedly verified that the bone fragments had originated from a cemetery in nearby Mount Hope. However, there was no explanation as to why they were taken from there or how they ended up at the site of the fire. According to Smithsonian records, the bone fragments were returned to George in September 1949, but their current whereabouts remain unknown. So basically, the bones that they found were probably had nothing to do with the fire at all, and they were either something that when George like bulldozed the area that he dug up out of the ground and like put on the site accidentally without knowing it. Or they were taken from a local cemetery, which is really weird.
This is what makes me think that there's something, along with everything else, that there's something sketchy going on here. First, the planted quote-unquote heart, then the planted vertebrae. It's just weird. The first were planted, but the second might not have been planted, like we said. They might have just come from the dirt that George used from the cemetery for some reason, or what have you. But there's just so many parts of this that don't add up.
Yeah, it's extremely bizarre.
So the investigation and its discoveries garnered nationwide interest, of course, prompting the West Virginia legislature to conduct two hearings on the matter in 1950. Subsequently, Governor Okie L. Pattinson and State Police Superintendent W.E. Burchett conveyed to the Sodders that the case was deemed, quote, hopeless, and was officially closed at the state level. Although the FBI initially took jurisdiction due to the potential of an interstate kidnapping, they eventually discontinued the investigation after pursuing leads for 2 years that led to no fruitful outcomes.
After official attempts to solve the case ceased, the Sodder family persisted in their quest for answers. They produced flyers displaying images of the missing children, initially offering a $5,000 reward, later doubling it up to $10,000 for any information that could provide closure for at least one of the children. In 1952, they erected a billboard at their former house's location and another along U.S. Route 60 near Anstead, both featuring the same details. Eventually, these billboards became a recognizable landmark for travelers passing through Fayetteville on U.S. Route 19, which is now recognized as State Route 16.
So, despite all of this, the cases being labeled as hopeless, the case being closed, sightings, tips, and hope did not cease. For example, on one occasion, George had spotted a magazine photo of a group of young schoolchildren in New York City, one of whom looked startlingly like his missing daughter, Betty. George ended up driving all the way to the girls' school, demanding to see her or the parents, but all of his requests were refused.
The family's relentless efforts triggered another alleged sighting of the children post-fire. Ida Crutchfield, who managed a Charleston hotel, and this is Charleston, West Virginia, claimed to have encountered the children approximately a week later. She said, "I do not remember the exact date." According to her account, the children arrived around midnight in the company of two men and two women, all of whom she perceived to be of, quote, Italian extraction. When she tried to engage with the children, she said, "One of the men glared at me aggressively, then turned and spoke rapidly in Italian. Suddenly, the entire group stopped interacting with me," she said. She remembered that they departed from the hotel early the following morning.
So, despite this, contemporary investigators actually don't find her story credible at all. The skepticism arises because she had only seen photographs of the children for the first time 2 years after the fire, and she actually waited 5 years before coming forward with her account. So, they have quite a heavy amount of skepticism regarding her story.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. George continued to pursue leads firsthand by visiting the locations from which tips had originated. A woman from St. Louis, Missouri, alleged that Martha was held at held at a convent in that area. In Texas, a bar patron claimed to have overheard two individuals making suspicious remarks about a past fire on Christmas Eve in West Virginia. However, none of these leads turned out to be substantial. Later, when George was informed that a relative of Jenny's in Florida had children resembling his own, he needed excessive confirmation that these children were indeed the relative's own children before he was convinced.
This is just so sad.
It really is. This is so dedicated.
The clinging to hope, the wanting for, you know, this to be solved. Yeah. It's just really sad. And also so cruel if some of these people aren't actually genuine or just trying to capitalize on the fame of the case. Just like horrible.
Whenever a case gets, like, especially like a missing person case gets famous, there are so many people who just start coming out of the woodwork looking for reward money or looking for fame and attention. Or honestly, sometimes they're just jerks and they just want to play a joke on someone that's hurting. And it's really disgusting.
In 1967, George traveled to the Houston area following yet another lead. A woman had corresponded with the family, asserting that Louis had disclosed his real identity to her during a drunken conversation. She believed both Louis and Maurice were residing somewhere in Texas. Despite George and his son-in-law, Grover Paxton's efforts, they couldn't connect with her directly. Local authorities assisted in locating the two men she mentioned, yet they denied being the missing sons. Paxton later mentioned that George harbored lingering doubts about their denial for the remainder of his life.
In that same year, the Sodders received a letter that they considered the most compelling evidence suggesting that Louis might still be alive. Jenny discovered a letter in the mail addressed to her, postmarked in Central City, Kentucky, and without a return address. Enclosed was a photograph of a young man, approximately 30 years old, bearing a striking resemblance to Louis, who would have been in his 30s at that time if he had survived. The letter read, "Louis Sodder, I love brother Frankie, little boys, A90132 or 35.
This is just very odd to me. So the Sodders enlisted the services of yet another private detective to investigate the letter from Central City. However, the detective failed to provide any updates to the family and actually became untraceable thereafter. Despite the setback, the photograph offered a glimmer of hope. While refraining from mentioning Central City or sharing any details publicly to protect Louis from potential harm, they included that image on their billboard. Additionally, they displayed an enlarged version of the photograph over their fireplace in their home.
That's so sad.
I know.
Like, so the only possible picture they have of their child, that just, yeah, it's really sad. And you know, that's true. They probably have no pictures of him. You know what I mean? Like very, very few.
Yeah.
Because it would have burned up. So I feel like the things that they do have were probably taken by other people as opposed to like taken by them.
Yeah. You know?
Like school pictures and stuff.
You have like a double kind of grief when it comes to fires too, because or any type of natural disaster, because you have the losing of loved ones, but then also all of your memories, everything that reminded you of them, everything like that. Cherished family keepsakes.
Yeah.
So sad.
In 1967, George confessed to the Charleston Gazette Mail that the absence of information had been a formidable barrier, stating, quote, "It's like hitting rock wall that we can't go any further." Quote, despite this, he pledged to persist, acknowledging in another interview from around that time that, quote, "time is running out for us." He expressed the family's desire for closure, saying, quote, "But we only want to know. If they did die in the fire, we want to be convinced. Otherwise, we want to know what happened to them," end quote.
After George's passing in 1968, Jenny and her surviving children continued their quest for answers about the missing children. John, however, chose not to discuss the events of the fire, simply urging the family to accept the tragedy and move forward. Following George's death, Jenny remained in the family home, fortifying it with fences and additional rooms. She wore black in perpetual mourning and diligently tended to the garden at the former house's site. Upon her passing in 1989, the family eventually and finally removed the weathered and worn billboard.
The surviving Sodder children, accompanied by their own offspring, persisted in bringing attention to the case and pursuing leads. Collaborating with older residents of Fayetteville, they speculated that the Sicilian Mafia might have attempted to extort money from George. They entertained this theory that someone was aware of the planned arson might have assured the children's safety if they left the house, potentially orchestrating their relocation, possibly to Italy, which would actually make sense because that would mean why they can't find them, you know, if they're like in Italy.
Mm-hmm. Right?
The family speculated that if the children had indeed survived and were aware of their parents' and siblings' survival, they might have refrained from contacting the family to prevent putting them in danger.
So Sylvia Sauter Paxton, the youngest among the surviving Sauter siblings, who was 2 when the fire happened, passed away in 2021. She vividly remembered the night of the fire as her earliest recollection. Quote, "I was the last one of the kids to leave home," she recounted to the Gazette Mail in 2013, reflecting on her experience. She often stayed up late with her father, engaging in discussions about the fateful night, saying, quote, "I experienced their grief for a long, long time." Sylvia firmly believed that her siblings had survived the tragic event. She actively participated in endeavors to locate them and bring attention to the case, even visiting crime sleuthing websites. Her daughter affirmed in 2006 that Sylvia had made a promise to her parents not to let the story fade away, vowing to do everything possible to keep their memory alive.
In the modern era, the family's initiatives have expanded to encompass online platforms such as websleuths.com, complementing ongoing media coverage. As media attention increased, some individuals examining the case have come to believe that the children indeed perished in 1945 during the fire. George Bragg, a local author who delved into the case in his 2012 book, West Virginia's Unsolved Murders, considers John's original account credible, emphasizing John's attempt to awaken his siblings physically before escaping the inferno. Bragg acknowledges that while the logical conclusion suggests the children perished in the fire, he remains open to uncertainty, stating, quote, "Logic tells you they probably did burn up in the fire, but you can't always go by logic."
This is kind of the point where we kind of go on to our own theories. I initially had the theory of what if this was the KKK, because they were really rampant at this time, especially in West Virginia, along the Appalachian area in the South, and also they had a very fierce vendetta against Catholics. The more I thought about it, it kind of made more sense that it would have been a cover-up by people in town or proliferated by people in town, I'm not sure, just because of these planted items, the threats by local community, the accounts that people were throwing balls of fire at the house, the accounts that they saw the children leave. Maybe enough of the police and the fire department were convinced to dislike George and plotted some elaborate scheme to interact with the Sicilian mafia, or some of them were in the mafia or were connected. I don't know. There's just so much to go off of here. It's almost hard to come to a conclusion.
Yeah, I will second that. This is a story that I've heard and like known about for a really long time, like years and years. And, you know, there are times where I'm like, oh, it's definitely going back to that Mussolini thing, you know, that comment and the threat related to George's, you know, dislike of Mussolini, that's definitely what's behind it. But at the same time, even though I think that has to be tied to everything, I cannot figure out what happened, how it happened. Why did they take the children? Where did they take the children? Did they take the children? If so, how did they get the children out without waking other people up? Why did they start the fire? Like, where did those bones come from that they did find? What about the heart? I mean, there's just so many facets of this story that just make no sense. And I can't piece them together. I feel like I have a bunch of pieces to like a couple different puzzles that are very similar. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, for sure. And there's also the fact that, you know, George left Italy at a very young age when he was 13. And apparently he was very reticent about talking about his life in Italy, what made him move. His brother went with him across the ocean to the U.S. And then as soon as he had dropped George off in the U.S., he immediately went back to Italy. And they didn't really have too much contact with their Italian family. So I'm wondering, did something happen in George's past? Like, was he connected to the mafia in some way? Or even just, unfortunately, I wonder if there was a history of abuse in George's family or something, and he learned to, you know, respond the same way. And I almost wonder if maybe the children escaped, or I was thinking the fact that Marion was asleep downstairs on the couch.
Like, and how like did they get out?
Yeah. I have no idea.
So weird.
Unless she was, that's what I'm saying, like she was part of helping the youngest kids get out.
But then why wouldn't she have gone too, you know? Like it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I have no idea. There's just so many, like you said, there's so many puzzle pieces to different puzzles that you were trying to put together. Because I think the most damning thing is the quote about the guy saying that, you know, your house will go up in smoke and your children's lives will be destroyed. But then there's also the random dude who was like, that's going to catch fire. people saying they saw it.
The guy who said the house is going to catch on fire, what if he wasn't saying it as a threat? What if he was looking at the wiring and was like, yo, they lied to you. This is not good wiring. You know what I mean?
No, that's what I think he was supposed to be saying.
Yeah.
That's what I think the family thought.
There's so many reasons the house could have gone on fire. There's so many things that could have happened to the kids. It's so jumbled. So confusing.
Yeah. I mean, I personally don't think that the fire was accidental at all.
Oh, no, I don't either. No.
Just because, like, even if it was faulty wiring or the fuse boxes weren't done right, the Christmas lights were still on. George had had it surveyed, like, 2 or 3 times by different companies. So then that man's comment immediately, to me, becomes less credible and more of a, oh, I'm going to say this so that when we do set his house on fire, it's more credible that it was an accident or something.
Yeah.
And to me, what I was thinking was, okay, the ladder is gone. They used the ladder to climb up partially, or maybe the whole way, who knows, threw this thing on the roof. It rolled around. Something caught fire. And then maybe they threw another one through the window of the office. I don't know. Like something like this. Yeah. And then they scramble down the ladder. They throw the ladder. Or maybe they use the ladders to, like, grab the kids. I don't know. And then they leave. And then, you know, the fire commences. But I think that's, like, the hardest part about cases like these. It's, like, even worse than having little to no evidence is having, like, an overwhelming amount of different things that don't seem to add up.
Yeah. I mean, that's why it's still so unsolved, because there's just so many possibilities. And it's very clear that the family themselves, as much as they wanted to believe their children were alive, they also, you know, were aware that that may not be true. I mean, that's why they had, you know, people come and search the rubble again and stuff. So, I mean, it's just,
yeah,
I don't know. Like, I feel like they were as baffled as the rest of us.
I went on a bunch of crime websites and looked around in the comments and some of the general consensus. And a lot of people think that the most simplest answer is the right answer. And it's that the kids burned up in the fire. They just didn't do a long enough search of the rubble. It was too cursory. And so they didn't find the remains. But I think there's so many weird aspects of this that I feel like it's not that simple.
Yeah. I mean, well, and even if that's true, and to be fair, there's a part of me, you know, always the skeptic, that is like, I think that that probably is what happened to the children. I think personally, they probably did die in the fire and it just wasn't searched very well. And when the Sodders had that expert come back and search again, that enough time had passed and, you know, George had already covered the site up with other soil and stuff. So it was at that point an even harder search to take on. So I think that it just wasn't searched the way that it would be today.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that still raises the question of, or it still leaves the question of, why did the fire start? Who set the fire? Did someone do it on purpose? Was it faulty wiring? And if so, if they did set the fire, why did they set the fire? Why were there those random uncharred bones? Why did the one police chief, like, leave the heart liver thing? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. It's just so weird. I don't, like, there's so many outsider infiltrations in this story between the people making threats and the people leaving fake evidence and all of this stuff. That's why, like, to me, it smells like something's being covered up. And I still don't understand why they would have covered the remains of the fire just 4 days after it happened and not have let the initial investigation happen.
Yeah, it was just such a terrible idea. I don't know, but I guess grieving people do things that don't always make sense, even to themselves in the long run.
But that is our Christmas time true crime story. Let us know what you guys think, because we're absolutely bamboozled. We have no idea how to sort this out in our heads. Yeah. So
I feel like everybody wants to talk about things like the Dyatlov Pass being the weirdest, crazy, unsolved mysteries. I'm like, no, it's this one. This is the weirdest one. This is so weird.
I feel like we also always tend to do ones that there's, like, an overwhelming amount of evidence and you could take it in so many different ways. And I think that's why we always get so tripped up.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like there's a one or two episodes where, like, as we're trying to end the episode, I keep going, wait, there's more. What if it's this?
We're like, the potentialities just keep coming.
They just keep coming.
Tonight at, like, you know, 1 a.m. we'll both pop up and be like, wait, what about this? We cannot be contained.
With that, we're going to do our sign off.
This episode of Wicked, Weird, and Grim was written and produced by me, Ara.
If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share. You can find us on all your favorite podcast platforms, and we'd be especially happy if you gave us a 5-star rating on Spotify and a nice review on Apple Podcasts.
We have all the social medias. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Patreon at Wicked, Weird, and Grim, and on Twitter at Wicked, Weird, Grim. Join our exclusive Facebook group for a look behind the scenes and updates.
Check out our website, courtesy of Wix, at wickedweirdandgrim.wixsite.com. Also check out our Redbubble for our Wicked, Weird, and Grim collection for fair price merch. Search our username, Wicked, Weird, Grim.
Little aside, but we have a Christmas episode coming for you guys. But it's less of an episode and more of a preview of this new thing we're rolling out. It kind of relates to our last episode and the episode before that, actually. But anyways, we will probably release something about that on Christmas Day as a little prezzy.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Merry Christmas. Happy late Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. Happy solstice.
Happy all the holidays.
Yeah. Happy summertime to the
Australians.
On those on the other side of the equator. Yeah.
That'd be so weird if, like, you went to Australia this time of year and it was Christmas, but it was, like, beach weather. Like, that's, yeah, I just can't. No. I couldn't do it.
It's like the Christmas in July. Not my vibes.
Yeah. In Australia, though, is probably, like, Christmas in winter. What? So, you know.
Yeah. We used to go to Florida for Christmas, and my parents used to say, oh, your version of a white Christmas is the white sand on the Florida beaches. And I was like, shut up. I don't want it.
I don't like it. I don't like it.
I was like, if it's not a Hallmark movie, I don't want it.
I feel that.
As always, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next Wicked Weird Wednesday with the Grimm sisters. Bye, guys.
Bye.